Hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit of Truth Church. Sorry for the little bit of a delay. I had a phone call that I had to take, and it was a good phone call, but I did have to take that. It was one of those types of phone calls that are very hard to get set up. That went a little bit longer than I thought it was going to. But thank you so much for hanging on here. Appreciate that. All right, so we're going to go ahead and get started with the continue on with our heresy series on the essence of heresy. And today will be a little bit shorter of a lecture as well, but I'm looking forward to discussing it. So first, we want to ask the question, what is the essential feature of heresy? Because there's things that are wrong or theology or beliefs that are questionable, and then there's things that are heresy. Like this is actually destructive to Christianity. So I'd like to go ahead and read this quote from the book. Quote, by the 4th century, the term heresy was generally being used regularly to designate a teaching that emerges from within the community of faith on the one hand, and yet is ultimately destructive of faith on the other. The central defining paradox of heresy is that it is not unbelief. It is rather a vulnerable and fragile form of Christianity that proves incapable of sustaining itself in the long term. Secondarily, he also said, it is not characterized in terms of questionable practices or ethics. So, in other words, real heresy, it revolves around beliefs. And it's very important to see that when we talk about heresy, we're talking about beliefs that people who are Christians hold, and that to some extent, they may not see or be willing to see or understand how it's actually destructive to the core of Christianity. And people can come up with all sorts of different ways and means and philosophies and ways of essentially justifying these other beliefs, but ultimately they do become destructive. And so heresy is essentially a version of Christianity or a version of a Christian doctrine that is intellectually defective or destructive. But again, it often comes from within the church, or at least it finds its footing in the church. Sometimes people may incorporate different types of philosophies into the church, and so they'll blend doctrine that could be syncretistic and heresy. But again, it's heresy isn't necessarily something that comes from without, it comes from within. Now, the other problem with heresy is that in general, people who do hold the heresies often will have a lot in common, but they diverge at critical points. And so heresy is dangerous because of the possible implications it can have on the future of Christianity itself. For example, say Athanasius' understanding of the Trinity never came to pass, and he wasn't there, and you have somebody maybe like Arius, who's now defining the Trinity. It's entirely possible that Christianity may have looked a lot more like Islam. For example, if you get this situation where Jesus isn't really God, then all of a sudden Jesus just becomes the next head prophet, and you have something fundamentally that looks the same as Islam, right? Where you have a head prophet and this sort of dynamic monarchian view of God. So it's interesting that certain of these heresies actually become very destructive to the church over time. Now, the other problem is this, is that when we're talking about the church and heresy, there's an intense pluralism that's going on throughout late classical antiquity, and it's still really going on today, much more in the last couple of decades. This intense pluralism, this intense blending of beliefs, this intense anything goes kind of belief system. And heresies make the church look more like those pluralistic systems of belief. Whenever you get into heresies, they always tend toward the compromising pluralistic belief system of the world's system of spirituality. And so with that in light, let's take a look at some of the early threats to Christianity. There were 3 main threats to Christianity in the first couple hundred years. The first was physical. In other words, there was always the possibility of persecution. There were suppression of Christian communities, there was threats of violence, there were attacks against leaders, I mean, you name it. From Rome's perspective, it didn't care whether the internal church people considered it a heresy or an orthodoxy or a sect or whatever. They said, well, it's all Christianity, we're going to persecute all of it because it's an illegal religion. It doesn't have protection from the government. Now, the second aspect here is there's this danger of intellectual religious assimilation. So in the very, very beginning, there was a pull toward going back to Judaism, to reverting back to Jewish roots. to going back to Jewish covenant markers, to going back to the Jewish food laws and really the Torah. And so there was always this pull, and you see this in some of the letters, this pull back toward Judaism. Okay. Secondly, though, there was also a danger on the opposite end, where you had a bunch of Gentiles coming in, and the pull there was to reassimilate back into Greco-Roman culture. Because again, Christianity was calling sort of everybody out of all of these systems unto sort of a new system and a new way of life. And there was always this potential of falling back out into either the Greco-Roman pluralistic syncretism with its morality or the Jewish legalistic structure of Second Temple Judaism. Now, typically, when you see a church begin to culturally assimilate, it often leads to the church going extinct. So what do you mean by this? If we take a look even in the modern era, and we see things like the social justice issue, we see things like the racial reconciliation movements and all this kind of stuff that's going on, we see things like, you know, the new spirituality, right, the blending of New Age principles to Christianity. The funny thing is, all of these churches, all of these religious movements end up looking just like the world. And therefore, even though they have their kind of explosion for a time, it's going to end up dissipating. It's because when the next new wave or fad comes through and that becomes de-emphasized, they're just going to become the next sort of social club type situation. And you'll find that they then decline. And we've seen this even. We've seen this in the large denominations, which have then declined for many years, many decades. And we see that these large denominations, which essentially began to look like the world, have continued to go. You would think that the mainline denominations would be doing great. You would think that the mainline denominations, which have embraced homosexuality, they've embraced false views of critical race theory, they've embraced all of these kinds of things, you would think they would grow. But the funny thing is though they may have some growth in certain areas, in general, they're on the decline. And the reason is because you can have those things without the church, right? You can have your whatever sexuality you want without the church. You can have your social justice theory without the church. And in fact, the church only seems to act as sort of this weird sort of place where it exists, but it doesn't really fit all that well. And so you end up just having less and less of the Bible, less and less of Jesus, and more of those other things. And then, well, what's the point? Why even go to a church like that? Why not just go to your social club, or why not just go to the source of these ideas? And that eventually is what happens. And so it's interesting to see that once you start culturally assimilating, you actually start to destroy the church. Now, Tertullian stated this. He essentially was very much against the idea of an uncritical importation of secular ideas, because he essentially was arguing for the idea that this is going to lead to the overall secularization of the church and the loss of the church's identity and integrity. And indeed, that's exactly what we see throughout all of church history when this happens. Now, the third threat that they were dealing with was this idea of the fragmentation of Christianity through intellectual incoherence. So this is where people from the outside would criticize Christianity. They would say, oh, intellectually you can't hold to it. Or, you know, there are cultural opponents saying, no, this is the wrong way to live. You had people like Celsus, you had people like Galen of Pergamum. And they essentially said that the core doctrines of Christianity could not possibly be taken seriously by an educated person or a cultured person. And so you'd have this situation where, you know, Christianity was, they were trying to relegate it to the rural areas. They were trying to relegate it to certain class. No, you see the same thing today. Ultimately, and this I think is actually very important, ultimately, you need to have the engagement of, people who like to think deeply, just as much as you need to have the engagement of people who simply live out the gospel or live it out. You also need to have people who like to think deeply about the Bible, think deeply about theology. And it's when the attack often comes not on the everyday person, but it comes on the intellectual and rigorous understanding of scripture and doctrine. Why? Because those are the people that are going to be teaching everyone else. And if you can dethrone and take out those people, if you can convince those people Christianity is wrong, if you can shame those people into being silent, if you can get rid of those people, then the general people of Christianity, the general people in the congregation, are leaderless. And so that's one of the reasons why the attacks come in that way. Additionally, if you can relegate it to the fringes, if you can relegate it to the rural things, you can say, oh, it's insignificant or unimportant because it doesn't have a place in the city. and that's another big issue as well, is getting it out of the cities. So many people are in the cities. If you get it out of the cities, you essentially isolate it out from large swaths of people. So there was a lot of worry that essentially these heresies were going to cause fragmentation. They were going to cause, you know, different churches that were kind of fighting each other or at odds, all of that kind of stuff. That was the kind of thing that was going to come to dominate this. And so there were worries there. And obviously heresy factors into the second and third issue. Now, what about heresy and orthodoxy's doctrinal concepts? Well, early in the second century, you have an interesting split in Judaism versus Christianity, where Judaism is essentially defining itself more by its practices and its cultural markers, its orthopraxy, its right ways of acting. And Christianity was starting to define itself in orthodoxy, right belief. And so you have this initial Christian self-definition that really revolves around Jesus Christ. Who is Jesus, his identity, and to some extent the role of the Old Testament law, the role of the Hebrew Scriptures is also going to be part of this. And with that, it's kind of fascinating because that's the focus. So what do you notice a lot of the heresies are about in the first 300 years? Well, a lot of the heresies are about the nature and character of Jesus. Is he God? Is he God-man? Is he just a man? Is he a hybrid God-man? Is he a fully God and fully man? Like, a lot of the heresies revolve around Jesus because that was the definition of what it meant to be a Christian, was who is Jesus and the gospel. Now, there's also an attempt to distinguish the church from the world. And so the early Christian communities didn't really have this precise and elaborate doctrinal formations that you will in the later, centuries. And so their meetings, the fact they were meeting together in isolated things, the fact that they were worshiping in the way they were, that was the separation. That you could call Jesus Lord was essentially the separation in the early church from all of the other things. But these doctrinal distinctives began to get reinforced by these sociological distinctness. So here's the issue. The Essenes, for example, if you remember the Essenes from the Jewish sects, they sort of isolated themselves. But Christians aren't going to do that. They're going to remain physically in the world, living among unbelievers, living in the masses of all of the crazy theologies and philosophies and everything else. And so what was going to happen is their doctrines and their beliefs were constantly being tested. And so you'll find that doctrine became the way in which Christians will be distinguished from the world around them. Because again, you can't always see someone's morality. It's not necessarily right on display. You can in certain situations, but in terms of what a person promotes or what a community promotes, that's much more open and on display in terms of this is what divides us from the other groups. Because again, there were aspects of morality that differed between the different churches, not in terms of what sin was per se, but in terms of how they walked out their prayer life, for example, or how they handled the reading of the scripture, or what types of documents they used in church, things like that might differ. But they really did double down on the creeds and traditions as the unifying factors. Now, additionally, you're going to find that in the hundreds, 200s, and 300s, that Gnostic communities are going to also start forcing these Christian communities to develop these creeds and fundamentally authorized statements of faith. And this would include things like the canon of the New Testament and different canons being produced, as well as adherence to what they would call the apostolic rule of faith, this core theology. So how did the early Christian communities then define and identify themselves? Well, in the first phase of this, the New Testament and early Christian writers, they emphasized the center of the Christian faith, and they didn't really police the periphery all that much. They said Jesus is the defining and marking core of Christianity, Jesus is Lord is the heart of the confession, and they linked this often to the resurrection, like Romans 10, 9 through 10. You know, God raised this Jesus from the dead. So the belief in Jesus as Lord and his resurrection are heavily linked. They also had fundamentally a theology of Christ being the head of the body. This is a communal and personal Christian existence. So in other words, Christ was the head both in terms of the church at large and local communities, but he was also in charge of the individual Christian. And so you have these issues coming up from the very beginning that, okay, well, who can set limits then? How are these limits going to be determined? Like, we have this core rule of faith, but what about everything else? And so there were really three different axes that this question was asked on. The first one was the cultic axis. This is essentially, how are we going to view the cultic practices of Judaism and the cultic practices of Christianity? I say cultic, not in the sense of cults, but in the sense of rituals, right? In Christianity, you'd have baptism and communion, right? Those would be they would call it the cultic aspects of Christianity, but they're the ritualistic aspects. But there was generally a desire to distance oneself from the practices of Judaism. Okay, in terms of ethics, there was a question of what's acceptable versus unacceptable behavior. we see from even from Paul's letters that different churches had different understandings of what was acceptable and unacceptable, and there were attempts to correct throughout the early church. And the final axis is theology. So there's emphasis on certain ideas that were going to be held to be essential to the faith. And so now as we begin to look at a modern model of heresy, we're going to talk about a couple things, a couple key aspects. And the first one, as I said earlier, is that it is externally it looks like Christianity, but internally it's catastrophic to the faith going forward. And this is, I think, one of the most difficult parts about Christianity in the modern day. Because if you think back to the 70s and 80s, and you think even further back into the early 1900s, and you ask yourself, what was the church dealing with? The church was dealing with the following types of heresies. They were what we would essentially call negative heresies, or deletions. In other words, they were dealing with people denying that Jesus was resurrected, people denying that Jesus was God, people denying that the Bible was the Word of God. They were fundamentally things that it was very easy to see that it was destructive to Christianity, right? It's like, well, no, if you remove the resurrection, if you remove atonement, if you remove Jesus is divine. I mean, these are things that fundamentally just destroy Christianity. And that's what people were prepared to deal with. That's the fundamentalist movement. That's the evangelical movement. These were movements that were set up to fight against negative heresies. They were trying to fight back and push back against people denying central doctrines of Christianity. But what they were woefully unprepared to deal with were positive heresies. And this is very evident as we move from the fundamental stage to the evangelical age. So fundamentalism could essentially deal with these heresies, the positive heresies, and by positive I mean additions to, trying to syncretize Christianity with other things. Fundamentalism deals with this by simply saying, we don't allow anyone other than if you believe exactly what we believe, and that's the end of the story. And it becomes so isolationist that it's just very hard for it to grow, because it's too isolationist and it's too rigid and too strict. Now, they don't have any of those types of heresies coming in, but one could easily argue they actually have other fairly serious problems in terms of growth and in terms of actually evangelizing other types of things. Like, they actually have some issues on that. The problem in the evangelical church is that it moved from a very good understanding of theology, a very good understanding of scripture as grammatical, historical hermeneutics, and literal hermeneutics. And then it moved into this sort of thing where, well, evangelicalism is so large and other ideas began to come in. And so you start to see this sort of amalgamation of all of these other ideas and philosophies that then find a home in various publication sources and all these different ways, maybe not in the pulpit immediately, but they find their way in a Christian publishing company, they find their way in a conference, or they find their way in various different ways. And so you have this stuff start to Trojan horse into evangelicalism, all these false ideas. And typically they're going to come from people who would use the church for their own personal gain or for power or to promote their own theology or something like that. These people tend to become very famous often, and their ideas tend to become dominant in the church. And again, the evangelical church had no good way of fighting against that, because the only true way to fight against that was a solid theological education for every individual member in the church. And as the churches ended up going seeker-friendly, as they end up trying to incorporate more things and they moved away from that theological rigor, you find that, oh, heresy starts to explode. Why? Because people didn't have the intellectual undergirding to prevent ideas from like that from really setting and taking root and causing lots of problems. So given that, we have this issue in modern day heresy where people will often tell you it's very hard to tell what's heresy and what's not, where it's very difficult to say, oh, you know, well, every church has some wrong beliefs. Yeah, okay, every church does have some wrong beliefs, most likely, sure, but not every church has straight up heretical beliefs. And the problem is this stuff's all lumped together because people don't even know how to see the difference between something that's heretical and something that is actually like that is just maybe wrong or a difference of opinion. For example, we can take a look at something like church government, whether it's Episcopal style of church government, a congregational style, or a Presbyterian style of church government, right? Those would be things where certain churches would argue that other churches are doing things wrong, maybe they don't agree with it, but they're not heresies. They're not fundamental, literal heresies that are destructive down to the core of Christianity, okay? However, when you start toying around the nature and character of God, and this is why I often tell people, you know, we can have a lot of diversity in terms of how we do baptism or in terms of how we do church membership or in terms of how we do church government. But when we start talking about things like, well, what does the knowledge of God look like? What is the doctrine of salvation? Who is Jesus? What are the fundamental attributes of God, and how do we parse these out? It's not that every deviation on those things is heresy, but I think we do have to we have to come to these discussions with a higher level of understanding that any deviations we make from what's been previously understood could wind us up into heresy territory really fast. And so there has to be a rigorous examination of methodology. There's got to be a rigorous examination of implications of these things. And unfortunately, in all today, it's all too people are all too quick to simply jump to the whole, yeah, it's totally fine, and there's no implications of it, and there's no issues, and we can just agree to disagree and believe what we want. And it's like, because, you know, it's like, say there is a catastrophic issue with heresy. You're like, well, I don't believe in the catastrophic ramification of my heresy. I just believe in my heresy. And that's a common thing, right? It's like, well, I know I believe this is right. I know it might have some implications that I don't like down the road, but I just ignore those. And that's the kind of thing that we can't do anymore. We can't sit there and say, well, I'm just going to believe what I want to believe, even though there are dramatic implications down the road. We have to be willing to come to the table and actually discuss and deal with these types of issues. Otherwise, we could be believing in things that could have serious ramifications. And the problem is when you teach these to other people. So you, one person might not have the belief in the downstream effect of the heresy, but when you teach that to somebody else who doesn't have that undergirding that maybe you had, for example, then all of a sudden that person's going to go further and further and drift further and further away. And so these are just some of the issues that we're sort of dealing with at this point in terms of the church and evangelicalism and heresy. And essentially, heresy is going to look a lot like the church. It's very problematic. Because again, for example, and, you know, my background in spiritual practice and things like that, with my denunciation of Christian yoga, Christian Enneagram, you know, the comment is, well, we made it look like Christianity. Well, yeah, you made it look like Christianity, but it doesn't mean that there isn't something fundamentally destructive at the core of it that actually is catastrophic to the Christian religion. That if everybody were to start doing this, you'd actually have some serious problems with both of those in terms of one's understanding of one's identity, one's understanding of God, and one's understanding of salvation. And so, you know, this is where this whole heresy thing really starts to pick up, is now that we're in the evangelical age, we're in this age of constant positive heresies or additive heresies, how do we actually fight back against that? And so that's one of the things that I'm going to be looking into as well in the future. But we're going to go ahead and cap it there for today. Next week, we're going to be talking about the early classical heresies of Ebionitism, Docetism, and Valentinism. And I'm looking forward to that. I hope you join us for that as well. And thank you so much for joining us here at Spirit of Truth Church, and I hope you have a wonderful day.